Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Happy Columbus Day. Charlie Cook of National Review in for Jim Garrity today. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for you as usual. If I had a nickel for every time Ezra Klein was the good martini, I'm pretty sure I'd have a nickel. He's making his first appearance in our Good Martini today. As most of you know, Ezra Klein is a quite liberal columnist with the Washington Post, but he was on Morning Joe today and minced very few words in talking about how badly the rollout for the Obamacare exchanges has been.
I really don't think people should self-pedal what a bad launch this has been. They've done a terrible job on this website. We're a couple weeks in now. People can't sign up. People have tried 20, 30, 40 times. I mean, it's one thing for that to be true in the first 3 or 4 days. It's another thing for it to be true 2 or 3 weeks in. One of the Obama administration's jobs, separate from all of the political stuff we talk about here, is to simply run things like this well, to run their signature legislative initiative well, to do government in a way that makes people confident and able to use it. On that, so far, this is been a big failure.
So, Charlie, obviously, if you go into the details of the plan, I'm sure Ezra Klein would probably still defend Obamacare in principle. But the fact that someone as reliably liberal and defensive of the administration as him is saying it that clearly, pretty impressive.
Well, it is pretty impressive, especially given that Ezra Klein is effectively an arm of the Obama administration. And if you look back through the debates over Obamacare, it was always going to be great. It was always going to be fine. He's always found a way of defending Obamacare. This isn't actually the first time that he said this. He just tends to acknowledge the failures a long time after they happen. I mean, it would have been nice, for example, if Ezra Klein had noted back when Obamacare was being debated and passed, and maybe even when it was being redebated after passage, that there was absolutely no way that the promises that the president made could be true, that there was no way that you can simultaneously, and as he's correctly written subsequently, there's no way that you simultaneously bring in all of these people with pre-existing conditions who couldn't get insurance and promise that every single person's premiums would go down, that they wouldn't lose their insurance, that they wouldn't lose their relationship with their doctor. Now, it seems to me the same thing has been happening with these exchanges. There's no Ezra Klein piece about how this was going to be a mess, even though he's presumably pretty well in the know and in the loop. There's increasingly evidence that the Obama administration knew full well this was going to be a disaster. They kept being warned. 11% of doctors thought that the exchanges would be ready on time. Only 30% of the insurance industry thought they would be ready on time. And all you saw from not just the administration, but its friends in the press was that it was going to be perfect. Well, it hasn't been perfect.
That is certainly the case. And you have pointed out before, based on your experience with the British healthcare system, America is on a very bad road right now for where this is headed. And all these warning signs along this road to the abyss don't seem to be deterring enough people. It's still been unpopular. It's been unpopular from the get-go, but there doesn't seem to be this alarm and realization that getting off of this road is an urgent priority. It don't seem to be there yet.
No, and what particularly frustrates me is that I understand the need for the press to feel as if it's being moderate and impartial. It's not moderate and impartial, of course, but it needs to pretend to be. But the way in which they phrase what's happening, from the moment that it was first mooted by the president, conservatives have had certain objections. They said, look, there's no way that it's going to cut the average family's health premiums by $2,500. That was a nonsense from the start based on a back-of-the-envelope calculation that doesn't make any sense. They said there is no way that this is going to have no losers at all. Of course, some people's premiums are going to go up. And then they said there's no way that government's going to run this properly because government doesn't run things properly. Given that these things are coming to pass, that we can see very clearly, not as a matter of opinion, but as a matter of fact, that premiums are going up, the $2,500 number was nonsense, people are being dropped from their insurance, and the exchanges don't work. And they have a weird way of phrasing it. They say this will add fuel to the fire of Republican criticism, or this will create a politically tumultuous environment come 2014. At what point were the critics right? When they're proven to be right.
And apparently we're going to be waiting a very long time for that. So on to martini number two now, the bad martini. And if you've been listening on previous appearances by Charlie on the podcast, you know he's not a fan of labeling anything the million something march, because you never get a million and then you get bad coverage because you didn't reach your numbers. But for the most part, conservatives, I think, were pretty excited about the idea of the million vet march outside of the name. What you had is obviously a lot of people, many veterans and other freedom-loving people, gathering on the Washington Mall, especially near the World War II Memorial yesterday, to protest the Obama administration, what they consider punitive action against the American people, and especially veterans, of closing down open-air memorials that don't require security when the government's fully operating. And so to barricade them actually requires more work, more staffing, and is just a slap in the face to the American people. There were lots of veterans there happy to tell their story to the media. What did CNN take away from it? They focused on the one guy who brought a Confederate flag and the one speaker, Larry Klayman, not a veteran as far as I know, but basically made a reference that the president, he believed to be Muslim, says he said the president should put down the Quran and come out figuratively with his hands up from the White House. So that's where CNN's focusing their attention, not the people who risked their lives in service to this nation and who were there to honor those who did give their lives in service for this nation.
No, I think it's probably worth saying that there are two issues here. The first is that saying that the president is a secret Muslim and should come out of the White House with his hands up is flat out unacceptable. So let there be no mistake about that. Secondly, I'm not a fan of the Confederate flag. I appreciate that most people who fly it do not fly it with any ill intent, but I do think that the Confederacy needed smashing and was predicated not just on the principle of slavery, it's mentioned 82 times in the founding documents, but also on a sort of progressive view of economics and anti-minority rights that no modern libertarian should endorse or find remotely appealing. That having been said, that's not really the point here. I went down to Occupy Wall Street for pretty much every single day for 3 months. And they had hammer and sickle flags everywhere. They had pictures of Chairman Mao and of Che Guevara and Fidel Castro and of Stalin and of Lenin. They had all sorts of anarchist flags, not the reasonable sort of anarchism, which I have no problem with anarchism in its peaceful iteration, but fairly violent anarchist flags and slogans. And the media nonetheless covered Occupy Wall Street as if it were a serious intellectual movement, which it wasn't, but they gave it the benefit of the doubt. Yesterday, of course, we see certainly not a million veterans in Washington, D.C., and they see one guy with a Confederate flag who I've been told by two different sources was actually told to put it away and fly a different flag. I don't know if that's true, so leave that on the shelf. They have somehow concluded that every single veteran who was there, of all sorts of different wars, ages, parts of the country, is a racist. Now, that is an unacceptable double standard. You don't have to agree with the Confederate flag being flown or with what one non-veteran said in a silly speech to recognize that the way in which these things are covered is unreasonable.
As long as we're talking about controversy and potential racism, let's move to the third martini now. For those who are sports fans, you know that Dallas and Washington, traditional NFL rivals, played last night on Sunday Night Football. And especially those around the nation's capital know that there has been a simmering controversy for a while, and it's becoming a bigger issue now about whether or not the Redskins should change their name because it is potentially offensive. And so Bob Costas, who of course raised our hackles last season during his commentary on Sunday Night Football because he decided that guns were the reason that a member of the Kansas City Chiefs had taken his own life as well as that of the mother of his child. Now Bob Costas is going after the Redskins, and this comes in two parts. First of all, here's his clip stating that, well, he's not even sure anybody actually is offended.
As best can be determined, even a majority of Native Americans say they are not offended.
And so beyond that, he then decides that even though Native Americans are not offended, well, darn it, they should be.
But think for a moment about the term Redskins and how it truly differs from all the others. Ask yourself what the equivalent would be if directed toward African Americans, Hispanics, Asians, or members of any other ethnic group. When considered that way, Redskins can't possibly honor a heritage or a noble character trait, nor can it possibly be considered a neutral term. It's an insult, a slur, no matter how benign the present-day intent. It's fair to say that for a long time now, and certainly in 2013, no offense has been intended. But if you take a step back, isn't it clear to see how offense might legitimately be taken?
So this private organization should change its name, and I don't have an opinion one way or the other. If the organization wants to, it can. If it doesn't, it probably shouldn't have to, Charlie. But the idea that Bob Costas thinks somebody might be offended, I'm not sure that's going to be enough to tilt the balance here.
Yeah. Your point about it being a private institution and thus able to set its own name is an important one. This isn't, for example, something I think that the president should be speaking about, which he did. I have an ideal role of a much smaller and quieter presidency in general, I suppose, so that might inform that. But I don't find that particularly convincing. I don't understand why it would be insulting or couldn't be a term of endearment. I mean, for example, the state of Oklahoma. Oklahoma means red man. Now, there is a difference, of course, between an idea or a belief system, say a religion, and somebody's intrinsic characteristics, which is why it is regarded as being much less offensive to criticize somebody's religion, based as it is on ideas, historical claims, and so forth, than it is to criticize the color of somebody's skin. There's nothing you can do about the color of your skin. But is having red skin inherently offensive? I mean, my cousin and her mother are black. That's a fact. I'm white. My sister's husband is Malaysian. I'm not sure that those things are particularly offensive. And even if they were, I'm funny about this in general because there is a line somewhere and I'm not sure where it is. I think I'm with you in not quite being sure what I think, but there is a line somewhere and crossing it tends to realm into rewriting history. I feel the same way about Rhode Island. I think that the full name is Rhode Island and Providence Plantation. And in Christopher Buckley's book, Thank You for Smoking, there's a chilling scene at the end where the senator is being interrogated by a Senate committee. And his aim is to have all films, all movies digitally remastered to remove the cigarettes because it has a bad influence on children. And one of the questions to him is, well, would that not be rewriting history? And he says, no. Think of it as making history better. That worries me. Would one necessarily call the team the Redskins now? Perhaps not. Does that mean that we have to change the name post hoc? I'm not sure.
Well, on that uplifting note, especially on Columbus Day, Charlie, we'll leave it there. Thanks as always for filling in for Jim. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. Charlie Cook of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Jim Garrity will be back on Tuesday. Please join us then for the next edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Have a great day, everyone.